The following is a live recording of a recent Pen on Fire speaker series event that took place at Scape Gallery in Corona Del Mar, California. For more information, visit penonfire.com. We have a reader for our submissions, and that's Lynette Brassfield. She is on the stool. And Lynette is the author of The Books and Selection, Nature Lessons, which is a novel based on her upbringing in South Africa. Did you bring puppies?
Just a couple, yeah.
And she's working on a literary mystery now called A Confusion of Stars. So thank you for being here to read. She has such an eloquent literary voice that I begged her. No, thank you. So now, our agents. Jamie Weiss Chilton, to my far right, exclusively represents books for children and teens. Jamie's career in children's books began in 1998. With an editorial internship at Henry Holt Books for Young Readers, followed by positions as an editorial assistant and assistant editor at Bantam, Delacorte Dell, and Knopf and Crown Books for Young Readers, divisions of Random House Children's Books. After returning to her hometown of LA, Jamie pursued her love of children's books in a new arena as conference manager and Golden Kite Award director at the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators before joining the Andrea Brown Agency in 2008. Welcome, Jamie. Sally Van Heitzman, in the middle, in 2010, just recently, she founded her own agency, the Van Heitzman Literary Agency, in Encinitas, just south of us. She previously agented 6 years at the Castilla Literary Agency, and prior to that, at the Sandy Dykstra Literary Agency. She's actively seeking new authors in the areas of commercial and literary fiction and narrative nonfiction. She's looking for projects with great writing, a compelling narrative arc, and an aha moment. I want to know if you want your aha. Sally gravitates towards stories and topics that explore the American experience in an ethical, pragmatic, and independent spirit. I'm so glad you could be here.
Yeah, thank you.
And Jill Maher, to my right, is an acquiring associate agent at the Sandy Dykstra Literary Agency in Del Mar. She's interested in commercial fiction, especially women's fiction, multicultural fiction, historic fiction, mysteries, and thrillers. She's also looking for nonfiction in the areas of self-help, inspirational, cookbooks, memoir. She especially loves travel and foodie memoirs, parenting, history, health and nutrition, pop culture, humor, and music. Thank you for being here. So now, the way it's going to go is Lynette is going to read a submission, and then they're going to read along. Here are copies. They're going to read along and respond off the cuff. They haven't seen these yet. So you're going to get sort of an insight into how agents deal with material that comes in the door. It comes in the door, comes over, you know, in the mail, but usually via email. And they read it and have a response. And so that's what's going to happen tonight. All of them may respond to a submission. One of them may. I really don't know what's going to happen here. But we can only take a few minutes with each because we have about a dozen to cover. So let's get started.
Okay. This is the first one. Dear Ms. Agent, when people are exposed to horrific violence, the resultant trauma spreads like a psychic malignancy that is hardwired into the gene pool. It infects future generations and perpetuates a cycle of suffering so unconscious, the origin is unrecognizable. Set initially on the Dalmatian coast of former Yugoslavia against the backdrop of the Great Depression, World War II, Katya's Song, a fictional biography, illuminates the lives, life and loves of Katya Novak, a lonely 8-year-old Croatian girl, and her struggle to survive the horrors of war. Little does she know, as she hides amidst the abandoned labyrinths of an ancient city, that her terror will not end with Hitler's defeat, but continue forward through her migration to Los Angeles in the early 1950s. Haunted by nightmares, Katya cannot abate the horrors of a past that reverberates throughout the next generation. Katya's Song traces the bittersweet journey of a family that strives to rise above a legacy of violence, poverty, and ignorance. Much like an heirloom tapestry that has been faded, stained, tattered, and torn, the family's fabric is meticulously mended and brought back to life. Although there seems little escape from human suffering in this story, it holds at its core a foundation for compassion, hope, forgiveness, and redemption. I am a Croatian American and a recipient of my parents' wartime trauma. My experience with family therapy and extensive training in psychoanalysis give me an in-depth understanding of multi-generational legacies. As an artist, I am compelled to share this story with heart, soul, and a touch of mysticism. Thank you for your consideration.
Anyone? I'll start with this one. Someone's got to start. Okay. I'm going to start with my very first observation, and it's not fair for this one because it is they're all addressed to an agent, but just for you to know in general, always address it directly to the person you're sending it to. Just when I get something to dear esteemed agent or something like that, I automatically go, ugh. If you don't know me, if you don't know Sally, you don't know who we are and what we are looking for, then you're just throwing things out in the dark. It might not be something that I want to look at anyway. So that would be the first strike against it. But ultimately, I think this sounds really interesting, and I would probably ask to see it. But I think the problem I see with this is it's so general, I don't get an idea of a story that it's giving me. It's really lovely, and I'm a sucker for Hitler. Anything Nazi related, but I don't see a story here. So,
well, that was one of the first things I kind of picked up was I wasn't quite sure what a fictional biography would be, because a biography is usually someone of known in some community outside of the family, so I wouldn't say if it's kind of a fictional memoir would probably be a better term, because biography throws it in a whole other category. So right off the bat, I'd be like, do they really know what they're pitching? And then the other thing that kind of struck me is when they're saying as an artist, I kind of want to know what you mean by that. Are you a visual artist? Are you a writer? Are you in what capacity are you an artist? Because I want to have a sense that you're familiar with writing craft. I mean, you obviously have a really strong background for a story, but like Jill was saying, I'm kind of, this leads such a strong impression of kind of the aftermath and post-traumatic stress. To be honest, a part of me is like, and the good part is? Is this going to be like Sophie's Choice is a fabulous, you know, novel, and it has a lot of dark things in it, but, you know, there is sort of a payoff. I read that so long ago, I can't remember what the payoff was, but you know, I'm talking about it. I hope there was one. Oh, Meryl Streep. No, but I mean, you know, she's, you know, part of that story is just, you know, the instinct for survival and the compromises that you make, and that's much more of a literary novel, so it's exploring things on a very deep level as to, you know, can you criticize this woman for kind of doing what she did in the context of what her circumstances were. So that, to me, was the payoff, because you're dealing with a lot of kind of ethical, moral issues that you may project in your own life and through that person's story. So here I'm like, I'm not really sure what the story is, and I would worry that it's so heavy that am I going to be pulled through the story. So I want a little bit more like, you know, what she's doing in LA and is there some kind of success in whatever capacity you want to describe success, like, you know, kind of family or does she invent something or something.
Just another general rule, I think if you're afraid that you're going to give away your story and this agent is reading it and going to run off and write the story, then not going to happen. You can give it away.
Yeah. Tell us who, or tell us, you know, what Rosebud is. Okay.
The book, the cook, and the hook.
Uh-huh. I wanted to say before we go on that your names were taken off, so they all say "Dear Agent" their prayer letter,
And if it's a novel or a memoir excerpt, it may not even have the title on, so I could fit all the text from the first page.
Yeah, I was just saying that as
yeah,
in general.
Yeah. Okay.
Attention, this is very specific agent.
There you go.
When a conventional Midwestern American family intersects with the island of Morea in French Polynesia, commonly known as Tahiti, the resulting cultural sparks ignite a conflagration that endures for three generations. The Yellow Lizard, an English translation of the Maori word Morea, is a memoir that follows my family's journey through the South Sea paradise, from the early 80s down to the current time. Morea, named the most beautiful island on the planet by no less a personage than James Michener, is indeed a paradise, but there is a dark side to this paradise that tourists never see. Part one of the book opens with the Maori creation myth and goes on to relate the history, geography, and politics of French Polynesia, as well as an account of my children's teenage years, when they began spending summers with their father in Morea. It continues through my son's eventual marriage to a Tahitian girl and their struggles to overcome their cultural differences and language barriers. Part three outlines their years on Morea as they build a house in the jungle, bear two children, and settle into what seems like an idyllic existence. There are tales of Tahitian family feasts with recipes, the social life of Moreas on the island, the laid-back Tahitian lifestyle, and the eccentric expatriates. This Shangri-La begins to deteriorate, however, after years of trying to make a living in a subsistence economy and enduring the island fever that afflicts most outsiders. Add the pervasive alcoholism that fuels the violence and spousal abuse rampant in the culture, contributing to the murder of two friends, and the story heats up. This section ends with the tragic death of my son in an all-too-common drunk diving accident and his funeral on the island, an event of some consequence for the locals. Part three deals with the aftermath of this tragedy, trying to make sense of it, and raising my son's two Tahitian-American children, who at the ages of 9 and 6 were sent to California by their Tahitian family to attend American schools. These children had one foot in each culture for the rest of their childhood, much like their father, with the attendant struggles and adventures inherent in such a conundrum. Island versus mainland, Lango versus Hyper, with their own tragedies and comedies. I am a technical writer and have published numerous computer and technical related manuals, training material, and online help systems. I have also contributed articles to local publications, including alternative healthcare periodicals, trade journals, and newsletters. I've traveled to Tahiti many times over the past 25 years and done extensive research on island history, geography, and politics, as well as read fiction and nonfiction accounts of the South Seas. Thank you for your time and consideration of my Tahitian memoir. I hope to hear from you.
If I were to get this as a hard copy, I would probably suggest that this author include, even though I didn't ask for it, just include 4 pages of the writing, because I'd want to have a sense that they are able to translate from like being a technical writer to being, even though it's memoir and it's nonfiction, you still have to be able to write in a fiction vernacular for a memoir to sell today and for people to want to read it. They want to be pulled into the story. So this sounds real interesting. I read a lot of Michener when I was a kid. My parents had them, and I just would read everything in the library, including the bad stuff. And so that's appealing on one hand, but then on the other hand, when you're like, oh my gosh, Michener's like 800 pages, and you know, it's like chapters and chapters of the history. And so when he talks about having that in part one, I'm like, how in depth is that going to be? And is that going to draw you into the story? Will I get to page 20? So in this instance, I would probably break one of the rules and add a couple sample pages, because I'd want to be reassured that they could handle this material.
That's exactly my very first. I started reading it and then cheated and skipped down, because that's what we do, and go right to who the author is, because I thought, oh, good. I'm a technical writer. Right there, I mean, you can put words together. You obviously have a good grasp of the language, but now I worry that it's going to be academic-ish. So, I would send pages along.
I don't do adult, but I do lots of query letters. And this one to me seems unfocused because there's part one, part two, and part three, and like you both have said, I think the story really, if the story heats up, as the query says, at a certain point, that's where the story really is, and I don't think that you're going to need a lot of background and background on the island culture because that seems like a whole different book.
Though in defense, I think that was how they were trying to sell it with the sex appeal of Tahiti. Mm.
It makes it different.
It's
the Kitchener model.
Yeah.
Kind of, modern version of.
Go to the next one.
Dear Ms. Agent, I am completing work on a first novel, The Quiet Children, and believe you might like to hear more about the project, given your interest in multicultural fiction. Tattles in Barnes & Noble's politics and social issues genre deal with subjects similar to mine. The 330-page manuscript is in its fourth draft. The setting is Central Western Africa, where shady practices in international banking serve to camouflage the sale and smuggling of infants. Elaborate schemes are used to facilitate the abduction of babies, to supply illicit adoption networks. Concern about the practice seems to be increasing, considering the frequency of news stories and special reports on the trafficking of children broadcast by organizations such as BBC and PBS. This suggests to me that a market for such a novel may exist. Gabriel, a 40-year-old American banker, is suddenly uprooted from San Francisco and must flee the United States to avoid being arrested. Hours before his departure, he learns of a gravely ill child who may be refused care because of being illegally adopted. While he is in Brussels, en route to a token job in Africa, a university medical student from the failing country of Zaire is killed in a clash with human traffickers. In Kinshasa, the child of Gabriel's Zairean colleague dies under dubious circumstances, and it is discovered that the children are being abducted by the army. A fraudulent coffee trading scheme condoned by the bank is used as a cover for kidnapping children and smuggling them to Europe, where they are sold for up to $10,000 each. Inquiries made by Gabriel's team on the eastern border of the country go too far. Corrupt officials are angered, and the three make a frightening escape to the riverport city of Kisangani. Their efforts to stop the kidnappings in Zaire may simply force displacement of the crime to other nearby African countries. 16 of the 35 years I worked overseas were spent in Zaire and the Congo, during which time I served as an attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Kinshasa. I directed the U.S. Police Assistance Program there and was subsequently appointed as an advisor to the presidency of Zaire. In that capacity, I oversaw a development agency devoted to maternal health, child health, and the welfare of refugees, and spent a great deal of time in the northeastern forests of the country. I obtained my Bachelor of Science degree from UC Berkeley in 1960 and began my law enforcement career with the San Francisco Police Department that year. This is the only query letter I have submitted for the project, and I would very much enjoy hearing from you.
I'll start with just a little something on this one.
Yeah.
Then maybe someone else can take it. I don't want to see it until it's done. If you're still working on it, the worst thing is to start reading something and have an author email you and say, "Oh, I've just revised. Here's the new version." It's like, really? I don't think so. So that's the number one. I mean, as soon as I saw that, I was like, "Oh, I don't have to read any further because you're not done yet."
Yeah, no, I would definitely say that you don't want to start querying if you're in draft mode, and you can be doing 6, 7, 8 drafts. So there's no magic number to that. This particular query kind of suffers from the too much information syndrome a little bit. I get kind of lost in all the details of the synopsis, and then the second. Paragraph is you forget that he's pitching or this person's pitching a novel, and
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I was worried mine was going to do that. you know, it says multicultural fiction in the first paragraph, but then by the time you get a second paragraph, you're like, it's giving so much sort of factual pop, current affairs information. And I think this is a reported enough issue that most agents would get it without having to give too much back history on it. And again, I think it's really dangerous to put so much detail in the you really need to open up the description of the project so that we really are curious and want to know more than kind of being almost oversold on it. So sometimes less is more.
I agree.
just one other thing too, and the bio is really fascinating, but it tells me nothing about the writing life of this person. So they're really qualified to write about Africa, but I don't know about anything else.
So. Yeah, because see, this could be a paper that he could write to a symposium that he's trying to fictionalize. And that isn't necessarily going to work in the marketplace that we are operating in.
I have a general comment about the last sentence of the query, which is, this is the only query letter I have submitted for this project. You can please say something if this is different for you, but in my agency, my experience, I expect authors to submit to more than one agent at a time. And that makes a lot of sense for you, and I don't recommend giving any agent an exclusive on your work. Sometimes agents ask for that, and you know, it's not a bad thing that they ask for that, but just know you don't have to give it to them even if they ask for it, and you can politely say, this is out with a few other people, but I'll let you know immediately if somebody expresses interest. And that's what I expect. I expect people to go out to as many agents as you want, but let me know right away if somebody else expresses interest so I can put it at the top of the pile.
Right. Yeah,
and don't just say that they're interested.
Right. And I very much encourage you to do multiple submissions. You're just going to save yourself a lot of time. And sometimes it's just a sensibility of an agent. It has nothing to do with the merits of your work. It's just you don't always know where we are in our work cycle. Maybe we have something that's similarly set, it's not identical to this, but we have something else that we're already working on that's somewhat like this, and we just don't want to have two, because then we'd have projects competing to the same editor. So you may not know why we're saying no. And so give yourself the best shot by doing the research, kind of looking at our websites, looking online. You can Google most everybody and get an overview of what we're doing. And then see, you know, pick the ones that you feel like you have the best shot and go from there.
Okay, next one. Dear agent, the novels XXX and XXXXX that you sold this year will attract a readership similar to mine, so I thought you might be interested in my story. It begins like this. Celie twisted on the hot vinyl seat and pulled her hand away from her mother's superiors. This Lakota woman's exotic good looks and mystical ideas intrigued her. It made Celie feel uncomfortable. Outside, a seagull took to the sky. Celie watched it soar and circle overhead. Wings spread wide, the bird coasted down, almost floating to a jagged rock. It perched alone there, safe from the siege of the crashing waves. Perhaps in solitude, she would find sanctuary too. I was a Dominican nun myself years ago. I not only witnessed some excesses and hypocrisies in the convent, but I met kind, devout women there as well. The Chosen Shell, my mainstream novel of about 83,000 words, traces the life of Sister Celia O'Rourke, a gifted 22-year-old teacher and writer living in a San Francisco convent in 1967-68. Celia questions her vocation, wrestling with the arduous self-denial it demands. Her attraction to Tony, a street-smart New Yorker, plus her encounters with a charismatic but sexually deviant Mother Superior, intensifies Celie's confusion and guilt. Plus, the cult-like environment finds behind convent walls threaten her fragile self-confidence. However, this book is more than a nun story. It's a journey many take, who, bereft of a firm sense of self, choose a life to please others. Celie, idealistic and naive, confuses a call from God with the desire to gain the respect and attention she's yearned for all her life. Celie's superior, charismatic Lakota woman, offers Celie the maternal understanding and friendship she's always needed. But later, she shocks Celie with sexual advances, then uses her power to punish her. Not even Celie's success teaching Latino children and the chance to publish her own textbooks can banish Celie's depression. Finally, her upbeat confidant, Sister Lupe, talks Celie into finding refuge at a retreat house by the sea. Dressed in secular clothes, Celie meets Tony there, a savvy Italian-American engineer. He has publishing contracts Celie can use in New York. He understands her loneliness too because of his wife's recent unfaithfulness. His words touch and magnetize Celie. Eventually, the urging of her friend Dennis, a Dodger rookie who's living out his dream, her growing bond with Tony upon discovering she's a nun, plus her faith in God, arms Celie with the courage to uncover family secrets, explore her sexuality, and finally choose her destiny. I studied with three local authors, and I took MJ Rose's Buzz Your Book class. My writing has appeared in Cup of Comfort Books, Irvine College's Literary Journal, plus regional and national magazines. I taught writing at CSU and worked as a writer in marketing for about 20 years. The Chosen Shoal's potential readership is approximately 150,000 ex-nuns who left U.S. convents in the 1960s and 70s, as well as thousands of readers worldwide who were influenced by nuns. If you would like to read my completed manuscript, I'd be happy to send it to you.
I think just right off the bat, this query is too long. I honestly wanted like about half as long. It's just the person needs to pick sort of a focus of the highlights or the hook of the story, and then just stay with that and entice me enough to want to see more without kind of that tipping point where you. It's almost like we read so many of these that we actually get kind of worn out. And so you don't want to try to throw every kind of aspect. You want to go after the heart of it and sort of, you're not going to be able to tell us all the myriad of plots and subplots that your particular project, if it's a fiction, might have. So you really need to kind of go to the core of it and then maybe expand on that a little bit. I think that's. And I'm not always crazy about excerpts of the fiction in the query, especially I didn't find this one that compelling because I don't know anything about the story yet. And so to have it at the top, I'm like, I don't even know what I'm dealing with yet. I'd rather, if you're going to do that, have it like on a separate page or something like that.
Yeah, I think I'd leave that out altogether. And the only other comment that I have, I echo Sally's feelings, though it was, after a while, I was going, oh, what else? But I think that when you're trying to kind of wrap it up, the marketing, I mean, this is a very poor example of the marketing, just the 150,000 ex-nuns, and then people who are influenced by nuns. You should probably leave that out.
Well, you actually, this person's doing themselves a disservice. They're making it sound like only nuns or nun-affiliated people are going to want it. And what we're looking for is we want a broad readership that didn't know they want to read about nuns and that they find that this is a very cool story and it's something unusual and different. And so you don't want to say, oh, my book's about ballerinas, so here's a ballerina population. Well, no, we want, you know... Oftentimes, if you're in a particular subgroup, you may or may not be a reader, and you may or may not want to read about it. So you don't want to kind of limit your audience there. And you know, we see that all the time. You know, like, I have a book about baby boomers, and there's 10 billion baby boomers, and they're all going to read your book. Well, no, they're not. That's not a marketing. That's just going to make you look sort of. I don't mean this to be painful, but it seems kind of amateurish to make those direct ipso facto sort of logic jumps. So I would just really recommend not doing that.
Yeah, if you're going to say this will appeal to, you could say this will appeal to people who like to read books about, you know, forbidden love or something like that.
Broaden it out.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what the larger story is here, is there's, you know, there is that... forbidden female attraction in a very legislative world, and that could appeal to a more secular audience than this person is marketing it to.
In the empty parking lot, Mr. Schaefer creeps along slowly, avoiding imaginary cars, maneuvering tightly around the end of a row for no one. I breeze past him and drive to a spot near where the sand begins, hoping he will stop making himself look suspicious, hurry up, and follow my lead. I push against a hard spot on the leading edge of the sunroof, trying to help the lazy old motor along so it closes faster. The car shudders when I turn off the engine. It shakes like an animal, like it wants to keep going. Peeling my shoulders off the sticky seat, I grab my towel and book and go outside to lean against the hood of my hand-me-down broken air conditioning Mercedes, a dark brown tank my grandmother bought before I was even born. I pose against the hood like a woman in a 1950s car racing movie, one knee cocked, one foot up on the side of the car. The hood burns the back of my thighs, exposed in cut-off shorts, and I have to keep switching my legs. But Mr. Schaefer turns down another row. I walk over to the strip of sidewalk that separates the parking lot from the beach. It would be more romantic if he had to come over and put a hand on my shoulder, catching me in a thoughtful moment while I stared out to sea. There is a simple wind-bent fence that makes a kind of runway down the sand. It is meant to keep visitors off the dunes and beach grass, and it tapers off where the sand spreads out black and wide to the water. There are larger, more popular beaches down the road, Lido and Long Beach, with cabanas and a boardwalk, arcades and ice cream. But I think Point Lookout for him, not me. I called it a date in our first email, and he flipped. He said I could not email him words like that, and he was worried about being seen because he knows people who live right off the boardwalk in the dingy, high-rise apartments with nice views. So it is not a date. And it's not where I wanted it to be, over where in another hour or so. People will begin building bonfires, and couples will wrap themselves in blankets on the sand. It is only the first meeting of our book club on a tiny, lonely beach in bright, unromantic daylight. But it is still the first time I have seen him in the 3 weeks since graduation, the first time I have ever met him outside of school. And I think the fact that he is here is proof that he cannot let go any more than I can.
That's the first page of an adult novel.
I can start with a quick comment, which is in the opening paragraph. There's so much description about the car that it's repetitive, and it also takes me away from what I'm supposed to be focusing on. And so I want to focus more on the characters, and you know, one really nice, well-placed detail about the car I think is plenty.
I don't really know what to do with this. I mean, are we looking at this as if it came to us as a query letter?
Or what our impression of the writing is?
The first page of the novel.
Okay.
Somebody's queried you, you asked to see the material, and this is the very first page.
I wanted to get more of a sense of how old these people are, because Mr. Schaefer in the beginning seems very, very old, and I'm not sure how the woman is. Because she's talking about the 1950s movies, but then she starts talking about it being right after the end of school. So you're confused, you know, certainly the title of the book and maybe other details will give you some information, but I think you really need to have more detail about that right in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, without any kind of preamble, we don't have a synopsis or query, you know, we're just trying to get our bearings as to who are we to follow. What's happening? What's the unfolding story? And I guess what threw me off is, you know, it makes it sound like this is a more of a mature person because he's already worried about people seeing him on the beach from these houses. So I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe he's middle-aged and he's having an affair and he doesn't want his friends to see him. But then the graduation 3 weeks, we're like, are we like talking high school? Are we talking college, grad school? I mean, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I think that the very last sentence of the page is the best one. I mean, really, that makes me want to go to the next page, even though I don't know what's going on.
What was that sentence?
Oh, right.
But it is still the first time I have seen him in the 3 weeks since graduation, the first time I have ever met him outside of school, and I think the fact that he is here is proof that he cannot let go any more than I can. So I think we're finally getting what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, we don't expect to have the whole story on a page, but I think what you're alluding to is in the very beginning, if you're going to give us so much description of the car and the parking lot, we're just literally gauging, is this vegetable, mineral, you know, what is it, you know, as a story, and so we don't really know what to hang on to. And then I'm like, who's Mr. Schaefer and who's the I? And because it's in first person, you don't really, you know the gender because she compares herself to this woman of the 50s. But then I don't really know even what years or decades this is set in.
You're going to really want to, no matter what, because somebody's going to pick up this book and open it and read the first page without the query or synopsis.
Right, right.
So you're going to right away want to hook them. And this wasn't exactly the most compelling hook you could have gone with just
maybe
for this story.
Put that last, the last sentence of the query that we just read, just put it up in the first paragraph somewhere, like the second or third sentence instead of the last sentence on the page.
Right. Yeah, because sometimes especially, I do notice this in novels that I read manuscripts for, the writer will almost spend too much time setting it up that we need, you know, and I'll actually skip to the next chapter to see if maybe the first chapter isn't even necessary. Do I really, or the prologue. I have a real issue with prologues. Unless they're a different time and space, I don't know what they're for, unless they're just chapter one and they call it a prologue. So.
Dear agent, whose name is spelled correctly, my 75,000-word coming-of-age novel about prejudice, friendship, and courage, and how two unsettling chapters in American history, the Civil Rights Movement and the Vietnam War, affect the fate of one family, two friends, and their community. Fate carries its own clock, takes place in Hadley, Mississippi, a town no bigger than a flea toad on the map. It's the 1980s, and racism lingers. But Jason Lee Rainey's friendship with a black boy named Samson never wavers, despite the bullying they endure from others. Jason Lee never knew his daddy, but he does know he marched for civil rights, and he's been told the man died a hero while fighting in Vietnam. The boy worries he won't ever measure up to that kind of person. He lives with Mama, a woman of unwavering strength, and his uncle Mux, a man of simple wisdom due to a head injury from his tour of duty in Vietnam. Mama holds the family together until her suppressed grief turns into a melancholy she can't shake and has to seek help at a clinic. Her absence coincides with Jason Lee's discovery of his daddy's handwritten journal from the 65 Selma to Montgomery March. It enlightens him and Samson about the true power of the civil rights movement and incites them to want to know more than a life in Hadley, to become men who make a difference. It's also when he finds out the real truth about his father's death. In Fate Carries Its Own Clock, Jason Lee learns the lessons of inequality, flourishes with a bond of friendship, finds the courage to stand up to his uncle for what he believes is right, endures the senseless death of his best friend, and is always true to himself. I wrote this novel as a work of literary fiction in the vein of Sue Monk Kidd's The Secret Life of Bees, and feel it's a good YA crossover due to the age of my 15-year-old protagonist. My fiction writing began with short stories until Fate insisted on becoming a novel. I'm happy to say that it received the first place award in the San Diego Book Awards, unpublished novel category, June 5th. I was a finalist for two Glimmer Train short story contests, took home best unpublished short story, and a finalist honor at the past San Diego Book Awards, and earned excellence in writing awards from the Santa Barbara Writers Conference. My first published story appeared in Art Times. If you would like to see the manuscript of Fate Carries Its Own Clock, please let me know. I look forward to hearing from you.
The first thing is that this first paragraph is an incomplete sentence. And it really confused me. There's like, do you see that? And so I think there are a couple of typos, and I think that like just the first sentence, hearing it read aloud, I was like, what's going on? And then I missed the second paragraph because I had to go back and see what was going on with that, why I didn't understand it. So just proofreading. In terms of young adult fiction, historical fiction is extraordinarily difficult. So while this could be a crossover, the fact that it's set in the 80s, I think is something that is going to be a hurdle.
I would just say, you know, the bio seems very appealing for, you know, looks like this person's really, you know, done some serious work and has gotten their work out and making, you know, some serious effort to get his work published or her work published. I like the title. I think it's a very cool title, Fate Carries Its Own Clock. I don't typically do YA, so.
But I think the author intends it as mostly adult and YA.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I don't know what the author thinks it is, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. It should be stated clearly in the top. My 75,000 word blank novel. Tell us where it is, where we need to put it in Barnes and Noble. Because otherwise, I mean, it gets down here and we finally learn that it might be YA, but we don't really know.
The Secret Life of Bees gives you a clue that's an adult book. So,
right, so
that's what sort of tipped me off is like, oh, okay, well, if you want to put it in that category, then it's not YA.
Well, I will say I think this is kind of one of those gray zones. I worked with a client who her protagonist is 13, but I pitched it as an adult novel because it had very adult themes and adult language. And it had a literary voice, and I would pitch it to adult editors, and they'd say, "Well, this is YA," and I would always have to come back with examples. I think White Oleander was one, and some other ones. So, when you get in a situation like this where you actually have to make a case, I do think it's really helpful to provide examples. You know, as this author did. If you have something that's a gray area, yes, you need to tackle that head on so that we know that you're already aware of what the challenges are and you've done a little bit of your homework so that you're doing a preemptive so that we're like, oh, well, this is YA, but then you're like saying it's adult, so then you need to kind of make that case. And I personally think that's always going to be a problem when you have a character that's a teenager, and it can go either way.
Yeah, although like The Lovely Bones or The Little Friend, or you know, there are a lot of novels that have young protagonists that are very, very clearly adult and would never, ever be considered young adults. So if you want to give examples like those, then you're telling the agent or the editor in your query letter, this is what it is. I would give more than one example. Definitely give more than one example in this case if you think it can be a crossover, because then you need to also give examples of YA books. Also, in the beginning, my 75,000 word coming of age novel, that to me is signaling that it's adult. Mm-hmm. If it said my 75,000 word young adult novel, then that's, you know, so there are these clues in the manuscript, but I think it's interesting that we're having this discussion, so that just means that it's just not quite clear enough in the query letter. But I agree, you know, the biographical information of the author is very interesting, and this is, you know, certainly something where I would skim the query letter, go right to the writing, read a couple pages, and then see what I thought.
Millions of us live in low-cost mobile manufactured homes, all in essentially the same, looks cheap, feels flimsy, architectural circumstances. We yearn for what people everywhere want, a nice place to call home. Yet nothing has been published to help us solve our common home improvement problems. My book is the nonfiction account, a prescriptive narrative that tells of the pitfalls and missteps, as well as the triumphs, of renovating and furnishing a 20-some-year-old double-wide mobile home. When I first saw the double wide, I winced. From its laminated wood veneer paneling and Spanish colonial furniture to its all avocado appliances and fixtures, it looked even crummier than I had expected. And now, I wish you could see it now. Little by little, the unlikely little house has become a real home. Still affordable, but comfortable and brimming with character and a certain refined, cottage-like charm. Through all this do-it-yourself decorating, the aim stayed true: to apply the classic principles of architecture and design to a lowly manufactured home. The manuscript has come together primarily around conjuring up the illusion of spaciousness within the standard 24 by 48 foot footprint, building in architectural details, where there had been not so much as a windowsill, suggesting room by room cost-effective design strategies, giving the home character with artwork and accessories, feng shui and zen. I tackle a storage conundrum and deal with entertaining in a too small house. I think of the book as a trade paperback, affordable for mobile homeowners. Of course, it should be available in bookstores, but among the ways to reach this specific audience, I hope there'll also be kiosks in all Lowe's and Home Depot and Ace Hardware stores. However I can and wherever I can, I want to share what I've learned about creating a beautiful home in housing's best buy. It's a concept that seems more urgent than ever. My research has led to you, and if you're interested, I would be happy to send you a proposal.
I actually like these kind of projects. I don't know that this query letter executes it well, because I think that they're again reducing their possible audience, and their approach needs to be completely different. If you read Dwell magazine, you know there's a lot of interest in manufactured homes, and they're actually kind of like the cutting edge of the leaves and the recycling and so forth. And I think that if this person had a different approach, they could kind of, there's all these really cool narrative nonfiction projects, like, you know, my day living in a chicken coop, or, you know, all these kind of going back to these simpler times, and it's like the egg and I, and people are kind of charmed by them. And I think this could be a funny, interesting story which could talk about the trials and tribulations of trying to create something out of, you know, like it'd be like the anti-McMansion, you know, like, you know, taking the McMansion and inverting it. I could just see a really fun cover. And I mean, there are these homes that they're building right now that are like 100 square feet, like a little, you know, and they're all about how little space that you can live in. So I think this is kind of an emerging trend, but I think it shouldn't be pitched to just Lowe's and Home Depot. I think this is, again, something that you could appeal to a wider audience and not say, oh, I got to make this marketable, and they have to be able, you know, mobile home buyers are the ones that I'm targeting. I think that's a really the wrong approach.
Yeah, I think this is a timely book simply because the economy is bad, and the double wide is more appealing than it used to be. But on the flip side, I wouldn't ask for this proposal because I don't know who this person is.
Right.
And unfortunately, the day of, hey, I have this great parenting idea and I'm a parent, book is over.
This person seriously needs to do a blog. This is the kind of thing that if they did a daily blog and they were a good writer, and that's the key. Blogs are not by virtue of themselves. Oh, he has a blog and he got a book. No, people go to the blog because the writing is fresh and entertaining and surprising, and just, you don't know what, you know, the writing of the day is going to be, and people will go back to see the next installment. So somebody in this situation would seriously need to have that behind them, where they're getting a million people. You know, that's the what white people like. He was a blogger. The guy that's like, shit my dad likes.
Oh,
he was
so
a blogger. Yeah. Or, yeah, he's got a book and a movie and all that stuff. Those are all people that had, but they were really good writers too. So it was a great idea. I think this is a great idea. Again, the query doesn't execute it well, and it seems like it would take a lot of work to get it where it would need to be. But as far as just the idea, it's really intriguing.
Yeah, that the beauty of it now is that you can make your own platform. You absolutely have to have a platform, but you can create your own to a degree.
Dear Agent, Katie Malone is a little girl who loves St. Patrick's Day. Every year she looks forward to hunting for four-leaf clover, building leprechaun traps at school, and the annual family dinner complete with Irish music and dancing. But even though her heart is joyful on St. Patrick's Day morning, her face in the mirror tells a different story. Katie's smile has been stolen, and the tiny, sparkly green footprints near her window tell that a leprechaun may be the culprit. The Lucky Smile is a 1,000-word picture book about a girl and the crafty leprechaun who claims her smile for his most precious treasure. No matter how hard she tries to show happiness, Katie's grumpy face takes the joy out of her favorite holiday. Using ingenuity to trap the leprechaun, Katie recovers her smile and learns the value of a positive attitude. As a school librarian, I searched for quality holiday books like a prospective panning for gold. There were many titles to choose from, but only a precious few that would captivate the children. Rarely would I find stories with appealing characters and playful humor that were all wrapped up in a teachable lesson. The Lucky Smile celebrates the fun of St. Patrick's Day tradition while demonstrating the infectious power of optimism. May I send you a copy of the picture book, The Lucky Smile, for your consideration? Thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, I think, yes, please send it to me. And this is a good time to talk about submissions, at least for me. The guidelines are on the website, andreabrownlit.com, and my email address is on there too. And I only take submissions via email, so everything you need to know is on the website. Per the guidelines, we accept the first 10 pages of a novel or, you know, the full picture book manuscript if it's 10 pages or under. And so this is a case where I would see the query letter and then read the manuscript. And this is a good query letter. It's the right length. It gives me a good amount of information. A couple of quick things to note. This query letter says that it's a 1,000-word picture book. We're finding that shorter picture books are doing much better right now, so I would say it should be 700 words or under. So that's just a general picture book guideline. I think this is a well-constructed query letter.
Yeah, I think the author hasn't said anything about, I'm saying she, I don't know why. Let's pretend she's a she. And she was a librarian, but hasn't written anything about what she has wrote. I'm gonna go now. What she's written before, but the fact that she's kind of been in the same place we've been in, where she's been looking for the gold, kind of endears me to her, and I want to read it. I don't even read these.
One thing that I think the author touches on a little bit in the query letter is that they have done some research on similar titles. Like, you know, if you're doing a holiday book or any type of picture book, it's important to indicate in your query letter that you have read all of the Christmas books that are out there, all of the leprechaun books, so that you know what your competition is.
Plus, it's not a clown. I think it would work if it was a clown story. I think people are afraid of clowns.
Okay.
Dear Ms. Agent, have you ever wondered that if dogs could talk, just what would they say?
No.
I read in your agent bio that you love sweet, funny, and quirky picture books. So reading about a 4-pound Yorkshire Terrier who narrates her daily activities with decisive purpose, humor, and affection for her owners seems like something you would enjoy reading. The Incredible Adventures of Tinkerbell Tulip the First is a 1,333-word children's picture book written from the perspective of the main character, Tinkerbell Tulip. The first of a series, this book introduces Tinkerbell Tulip's personality, daily activities, and life perspective, setting the scene for her many adventures to come, meeting her first brain man dog, the boxer pup, flying first class on an airplane, eating at the human table at a dinner party. Tinkerbell's voice is straightforward yet silly, much how children themselves think and speak. Readers can giggle as Tinkerbell sticks her tongue up her owner's nose, identifies with the lists, and rules Tinkerbell makes and follows and relate to the love she has for her parents. After graduating with a BA in English Literature and receiving the Chamber of Commerce Award for Writing Excellence, I have continued to write both fiction and nonfiction. I am a member of SCBWA, have had articles published in the Tribeca Canyon News, and currently write ad copy for local companies and marketing campaigns. To keep myself creative, I write sketch comedy with the OC Crazies and am an active participant in local poetry readings. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Okay, so per the last query letter, this one now is a picture book of 1,300 words, which I think it could be cut in half. So that's just telling me that this is too long. Not to say I wouldn't look at it, but that's just what I'm seeing right off the bat. I would be very hesitant to pitch anything in the children's book market as part of a series, whether it's a picture book or a novel, because I sell, the first book generally has to stand alone, sell well, and then the publisher will consider a series, not the other way around. So even if you do have series ideas in mind, that's great, but I'm not really interested in considering it as part of a series that I will then sell as a series. And then at dinner tonight, we were talking about beginning your query letter with a question. So why don't you ladies talk about that?
Go ahead.
Don't do it. often I'll say no. Have you ever wondered what dogs could? I can't read or talk today. So anyway, you're really taking a gamble asking us a question, because there's a good chance we're going to say no, and just psh, we're done. Not necessarily true,
well,
but.
Well, and it's kind of like a Seinfeld setup, it's like, you ever wonder why they butter their, you're like, no. And as they have the, long field, if you're a trial attorney, you never ask a witness a question you don't know the answer to, because it's a leading question and you don't want to set yourself up. So I think having the hypothetical and the first lead sentences is not a good idea.
And I think this also goes to unnecessarily narrowing your audience as well. Your people who are interested in your book to be people who would never have asked that question of themselves ever, and yet they find that they're fascinated. So, this shouldn't just go to dog lovers. So I think that the question is narrowing your audience right away.
Looks like these next few are the first pages of a submission rather than a query letter, is that right?
I think the rest might be.
Paola. On the night all the twinkling stars danced in the dark blue sky, a baby was born, Paola. She was the third in line. Birth. What happened to my childhood? It all seemed so simple. One minute I'm the center of the universe, and the next minute I'm as insignificant as a dust particle in outer space. To regain my significance, I often ask my mi familia to recount the story of when I was born. At night, after snuggling under the warm, heavy, handmade orange wool blanket with black flower designs that we bought from a Polish man in downtown Lima, Mama, a slender, sophisticated woman with dark brown, wavy hair, compassionate brown eyes, and full lips usually covered in mauve lipstick, always dressed in the latest fashion, sat at the end of the bed to recount my birth. I listened with wide eyes and focused ears, as if this was my first time hearing it. From the very beginning, Papa desired a baby boy. Rosetta and Mia, at 11 months apart, were considered twins. Papa predicted the third baby, a boy. He would be Pablo. After me, he declared, with a certain confidence in his voice. At first, me Papa was very disappointed when I was born. As the third girl, me Papa held me in his strong arms, looked at me with teary eyes, and proudly declared out loud my name, Paola, without a doubt.
I think, this is intriguing. There are a lot of different parts here. You can see, if you're looking at this, that the first sentence was kind of an epigram on the top of the page, and then it goes into the manuscript. I think the author is trying to convey too much information in too short a time, which I think is very, very common, and I understand that, you know, the reason that you're doing that. But the second sentence is 8 lines long, and the reader, especially a young adult reader, I don't know if this is going to be a middle grade novel or a young adult novel, but whoever this reader is, it's going to get tripped up by a very long sentence here with a lot of description of the mother, where we really want to know more about the girl here. I think it's a fascinating beginning of a story. It's just trying to pass a little too much in to the beginning. One more thing I was thinking of. Do you guys want to say anything?
I don't do children's books, but I just wonder if this, how old this person, the narrator is, because the language is not childlike in any way. I don't know how old this person is.
Yeah, well, certainly going to be, for a sophisticated reader of middle grade age, I would say, or adult age. But then here, you know, another thing that we're doing here is starting with a question, what happened to my childhood? And then, what happened to my childhood? It all seemed so simple. One minute I'm the center of the universe, and the next minute I'm insignificant. I think that is all telling as opposed to showing, and we all know that you should show, not tell. So I think that that was something that was written by the writer to kind of help the writer get into the story, and we don't actually need that. So I would kind of jump right into the scene where the main character is asking for the story to be told and go right into that.
I'm just curious, based on the first page, do you get an imprint on how old do you think the narrator might be? Because, I mean, that sentence is kind of sophisticated. I'm as insignificant as a dust particle in outer space. So either this is an angsty 12 or 13-year-old, or are we talking, I mean, could it be younger than that?
No, I don't think that this is a narrator younger than 13. So I think that this is middle grade, which is usually categorized as 8 for ages. For readers, 8 to 12, which usually means that the main character is 12, 13, 14. Or if it's young adult, the main character is, at the youngest, I would say 14, maybe 15, 16, 17. It could go either way. It's hard to tell.
Oh, downtown Lima. Okay. I was noting that it was Lima, Peru. Yeah. Which might also be a clue that we're dealing with a more traditional family than you normally read in America. You know, I say it's because that's America too. So that would obviously make it. It could be contemporary.
Oh yeah, I think this is contemporary.
I'm reading this and I think it's contemporary. Part of the reason I think that is because selling something historical is very, very hard. And so I hope that it's contemporary.
She's willing it.
Yeah, I really want it to be contemporary. I don't really see any reason that it would, that in order to, if you're writing historical, and that includes the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, that's all historical fiction.
That was a 50-year-old for antiques.
No, not in kids. I think there has to be a pressing reason that it must be set in the historical period that it's set, otherwise it needs to be set today. So that's my feeling about middle grade and young adult literature.
And this is why you want to pick the right agent for your work, because I would not know those nuances. I wouldn't.
No.
I would be like, what?
Yeah.
10 years is historical?
Did you know that?
No. This is an adult novel. It says so. Over $7 trillion of financial transactions take place every day, about the same as the annual gross domestic product of China and Germany combined. Most of it is handled by banks, brokerages, mutual funds, and hedge funds. Almost none of it is in cash. In fact, most of it is conducted electronically over a super secret international financial network known as SWIFT, which is short for Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. A
the time, I didn't know anything about SWIFT or the role it was about to play in my life. But I was about to find out that what you don't know can hurt you, even kill you. It had rained the day before, rinsing the air of its customary ashen complexion, and a brisk onshore flow was pushing any new contaminants inland to the cheap seats in Corona and Riverside, leaving Huntington Beach fresh, renewed, colors as intense as a Rothko painting. Even the breeze had attitude. It flew off the vitreous waves, fluttering the green fringed fingers of the Mexican fan palms that lined the blacktop path where I liked to run. A slender line of clouds, soft as a wish, lay to the west beyond the Queen Mary and the cluster of smokestacks, cranes, and high-rise towers that was Long Beach. 26 miles to the west, the usually obscure Catalina Island gleamed as if detailed in one of the multitude of car washes that Southern Californians frequented to rinse away the grit and grime of life from their cherished vehicles. A brown pelican glided low on wings of prehistoric aerodynamic design and then plunged into the sea in search of breakfast. A German shepherd ran barking into the surf. What started out as a fine spring day for a jog was about to end in tragedy. Very soon, I'd be running for my life.
I'm just looking at you. Okay, so it's a whole page and I haven't, nothing's happened. We've had two foreshadow references and a lot about the scenery, but nothing.
Well, I mean, I see this person's, you know, trying to set it in Southern California and adding color. Maybe because I'm a Southern Californian, I'm always a little leery of some of the cliches of like our, you know, overvalued cars and this and that. I don't know. I don't know how that plays in other parts of the country, but I just sort of think that those are kind of easy cliches and that you should try to kind of go somewhere fresher than that. And I also don't always, I see this so much, a lot, and you must understand, some of the things that we have little our pet peeves about is because we don't see these things individually, we see them over and over and over again, so after a while we get kind of oversensitized to them. And so a lot of times you'll see these scenes where it's like the dog running and catching the frisbee and the little girl going into the beach and all these things, and they're trying to set a scene, but then after a while it just seems kind of, you know, boring. I don't know what all else. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know how to.
Yeah, and this seems like a prologue too.
Yeah.
I'm
kind of like, okay, the first paragraph's like high finance. And then the next paragraph. But then it's high finance with a hook, the kill hook. I'm gonna be killed soon because I have, you know, obviously know something having to do with high finance. Then the next paragraph is kind of scene setting, kind of, you know, contrasting Long Beach to the coast to inland, and then it goes back to I'm gonna die. I know something, and I don't really have anywhere to go with this. So
I think it just seems like a prologue and. Maybe the actual novel will start the next page.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, trying to do too much description right at the very beginning, where these, you know, some of these very nice descriptive phrases could be parceled out throughout the manuscript, and you can maybe do one. I like the detail of the palms that line the bluff top path where I like to run, because that tells me something about the character. So keep that, maybe, and then you don't need the rest of the paragraph. you know, and I mean, those are, you know, some of those nice descriptions should be used elsewhere, but at the beginning, you know, all you need to know is that we're in LA and there's this murder for, you know, or there's something gonna happen, and then more about the character and less about the city. Even if the city is going to be a really important character in and of itself, you still need to get to know the character first, I think.
Love You Bye, a memoir.
It was dawn when I headed down from my loft bedroom, down steps that wouldn't have been out of place in a submarine, except these were oak and didn't have any banisters. I mostly skipped down, just the way I do things. My husband Larry half crawled, cautious man. That's when he used to sleep with me. This was before he retired with a capital R. One thing and another, and he started spending more and more nights downstairs in our southwestern huge sectional, large enough for two adults, two dogs, and maybe a 10-year-old. He made half-assed excuses, how to become too hot upstairs, too crowded in bed, with Speepy and Jake, our dogs. And of course the staircase, all of a sudden too dangerous to crawl down in the middle of the night when he had to pee. He was the one who built it, the one responsible for its railless state. No big deal in the beginning. He was tired of the project by then, and now he was sick of working on the house. I dressed quickly for work in the room below, a kind of dressing room come office, using the closet light to see. I didn't want to wake Larry next door in the living room. The dogs had clonked downstairs a couple hours earlier, and he would have let them out to do their business. The light went on in the kitchen, followed by the thud of the refrigerator door. I grinned. I liked it when Larry got up with me in the morning. It didn't often happen. It usually meant fresh squeezed orange juice, maybe an improvement in his attitude. By the time I'd brushed my teeth and slapped on makeup, he was perched on the ratty footstool in the kitchen, the newspaper between his hands. He wore his usual shorts, surf sweatshirt, and flip-flops. Sweet Pea and Jake, Staffordshire Bull Terriers, picture a cross between a pot-bellied pig and a cartoon warthog from The Lion King, were doing their rather dog charge through the dining room and kitchen.
Well, for this one, we get a good sense of her voice in the first page, just with little nuances. Try to find one. But anyway, I think that we could use more of that, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Anyone?
No, I couldn't read it, so I was having trouble.
Is it the light?
Yeah,
do you want to switch this?
No, oh, that's better. Oh, that's much better. Thank you. Okay, cool.
I think we get a good start with these two characters, getting to, you know, have a pretty good sense of both of them right in the beginning, and, you know, the house project and the couch and the funny stairs. But I think that, you know, certainly in memoir often there is this urge to tell too many details. Like, I wouldn't necessarily say that the dogs are Staffordshire Bull Terriers unless that really becomes an important detail, because I think when you have dogs, you know, even though it's a memoir, you want to allow the reader to get their own image, or maybe say that they are the Bull Terriers, but then you don't have to say picture across between this and this, because either you have a picture in your mind of these terriers or you don't, but it's not that important, so to keep the focus on the main characters.
I found my example.
Oh, okay.
And I lost it again.
Oh, no.
Something about where he had to go downstairs to pee. Just to her casual voice, that seemed more appealing to me, and less, she didn't seem too stuffy. She seems like a fun person. Where Larry...
Yeah, she's kind of snarky when she says... of course, the staircase, all of a sudden, too dangerous to crawl down in the middle of the night when he had to pee. He was the one who built it, the one responsible for its real estate. You know, I mean, you get a sense of her anger toward him, but it's not really, it's funny.
That is going to end this portion of the event. We're going to take a few questions. Does anybody have a question? Yeah.
I don't read children's books, or I haven't tried that yet, but I have a question. If you're submitting a child a picture book, are you supposed to include artwork, work with ours? Are you supposed to say that you're just submitting the work?
That's a good question.
I want to repeat the question for the recording. If you're submitting a picture book, should you also submit illustrations or do the artwork?
No, not unless you are an author illustrator, and that would mean if you went to art school and have a degree in illustration. Almost always.
Any other questions?
Sarah?
Do you have... like anything that you're looking for, or what are your thoughts on trends?
What are your thoughts on trends, and are there very specific things you're each looking for?
I always say, you know, don't write to the trends. It's important to sort of know what's out there, but by the time something becomes a trend, like dystopian right now in young adults, if you start writing a dystopian right now and it's done in a year or two, and then, you know, then the trend is long gone pretty much. So you just have to write what you really, really want to write, what you love, and your best writing will come out when you're writing that. So just encourage you to write whatever it is you want to write. Don't pay too much attention to trends. And in terms of what I'm looking for, I'm open to everything. I'm really specifically looking for young adult novels right now, but I do everything from very young picture books through crossover, very adult YA.
I think that, you know, all of us have websites, and if you go on the websites, you can get a pretty good impression from the books that we've represented in the past. What kind of the arc of our interests. I mean, I'm saying for myself, I can't tell you what I'm specifically looking for. It's like I kind of know it when I see it. I guess I would say that I try to be mindful of trends, but I also like things that I don't think have been overexposed. Even though I am actually working on a vampire novel right now, which I didn't think I would ever do, but there was something kind of compelling about this one in particular, so I've just thrown caution to the wind. But I wasn't looking for it, and it's just one of those things. So, again, it's helpful if you're looking for more of a sensibility, maybe, than a specific topic with an agent.
Yeah, I'm looking for really great writing and a fantastic story. Always.
Well.
Okay, me too. But just to kind of sum up the trend issue, we're always kind of trying to see what the trend is, but of course you always have to be five steps ahead. An editor I worked with in New York last month, she, at the time that we first started working with Sandy, my boss, she was really buying a lot of women's fiction, a lot of really suspense women's projects. And her boss came to her and said, "Why do you keep buying these books? We're looking for the next Dick Francis. Stop picking up women's books. Who cares about these stupid alphabet murders?" So. Luckily, the editor was right. And I wonder if her boss was fired. But it just goes to show you that you cannot predict trends. If you could, we'd all be bazillionaires.
I do think that it's helpful to just be very well read and read a variety of magazines and online newspaper, just to sort of get a feel for. I mean, one project I took on and this is true of most projects, like, we might meet a client, sign them up, work on getting their work out, which may take a while. And so it may be a 2-year cycle before their book actually comes out. So one of my client's books is coming out next month. Well, 2 years ago, or approximately a year and a half ago, is when I met him. And he was writing a nonfiction book about sort of the college tuition bubble and how tuitions were being inflated and that there was other options to going to college that might actually be beneficial to students. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. You know, I've read a couple things about it, but tell me more. So I sold it. This issue has really hit the fan this year, especially with the economy, and the New York Times has been featuring this topic frequently. And so, you know, we're kind of thrilled. We're getting a lot of media attention, but I didn't go out looking for this project, but when it was presented to me, it just hit all the right buttons for things that I'd just been reading on my own and kind of picking up some threads. And that happens frequently, you know, where, you know, we're just trying to figure out things that are of concern to readers in general.
And the agents brought lots of materials. I see handouts and business cards, and you brought all kinds of things. So I think most of us are kind of steamy in here. So I think we're going to break now. Our agents will stay here for a little bit. You can come up, get cards, ask personal questions, tell jokes, whatever. And come in. We have books and wine and nibbles. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.